Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Doe.
And this is the podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what have you been reading on time this week?
Rather unexpectedly for all of us, I've been reading a book called On Sheep, Diary of a Swedish Shepherd.
Okay.
By Axel Linden, which is translated by Frank Perry. Published by Quercus a couple of years ago, 2019. This happened because at work we have a shelf, a book swap shelf, where people bring in books they don't want anymore, or if they've been sent a proof that they don't necessarily fancy, or they've read it and they want to pass it on. General book swap shelf. And one day this book turned up on it, and I've no idea which of my colleagues had brought in On Sheep, Diary of a Swedish Shepherd. If you are my colleague who brought it in and you were listening to this, then thank you, because unexpectedly I loved it. It's just it's so not the kind of thing I would have bought. It's about Axel Linden, the author, who lived in a city in Sweden, and sort of deemed himself quite socially conscious, you know, trying to reduce the amount of meat he was eating, and going vegetarian and trying veganism, and, you know, trying to, you know, paying attention and thinking how outrageous it was that everything that has happened with the climate and everything like that, and how we really need to get back in touch with the land and what have you. And his parents lived on a sheep farm somewhere in Sweden, quite obviously very rurally, and they were going to sell it. And so he decided that, along with some other people, they would go there and sort of start a commune, essentially, that they would have, you know, vegetable gardens and paddocks, and they would be a sheep farm, and, you know, the kind of agricultural buildings, and just try and sort of live on the land, try and be somewhat self-sufficient, and just sort of live that kind of much smaller life. And of course, inevitably, lots of people kind of come and go from the commune. He's really the only one that stays constant. And the book is a diary, as the title would suggest, but it's just all his diary entries of him getting used to it, of learning how to sheep farm, of learning everything that goes into actually the realities of this kind of living. And of course, unsurprisingly, he has quite the wake-up call. The very first diary entry, 3rd of July, bah. So there they are. I can't really see them, but they're usually over in the copse. The sheep, or a sheep, singular and plural, the same word. because if you're afraid of being lonely, you've probably never enjoyed true companionship. If you're afraid of being insignificant, bah. So I read this and was just like, well, I'm taking this home with me. This is incredible. Little tracks are appearing in the paddocks. The sheep step behind one another to avoid wearing down the pasture. It would never have occurred to me to do that. The ewes are all neatly arranged beside the vegetable garden. The group doesn't look that big. There should be 12 ewes plus 16 lambs, but from this far away, it looks more like 9. They seem content. They like lying on a slight slope and looking down as though they were in control. So there's just all these sort of oddly meditative entries on sheep farms, and he gets increasingly infuriated with a hole in the fence. These sheep kept getting out, and he's trying to work out how to stop the sheep getting out, and eventually gets an electric fence. That's a big thing that happens. He learns much more about the economics of running a farm and what you have to sell and what you do this. And on, you know, in, all the way through, he refers to real farmer. What a real farmer would do, knowing that he's sort of this imposter. And then by the end, you realise that he's now a real farmer too. And it's just weirdly joyful and sort of a lot of deadpan humour, and I just loved it. I would never have bought it. So thank you, anonymous colleague, for leaving On Sheep, Diary of a Swedish Shepherd on the shelf, because I just adore it. And I hope he's still on his farm, and I hope he's happy with his sheep.
Now, when you started talking about this, I thought, oh, it's going to be one of those middle class dickheads from the city moves to wherever, which it does sound a little bit like it might be, but also that he's got a bit more self-awareness than your normal middle class dickheads moves to Shetland or wherever and like makes a hash of it and thinks that
oh, I hate those books.
Yeah, like this is why I was intrigued as to why you'd picked it up. I also quite like that sometimes you stumble across things that you'd never have picked up and then they turn out to be great. I love that.
Yeah, I read it in one day when I was on holiday the other week and I just loved it. It was so kind of, and I think probably the way that he's got that slight self-awareness is that his parents had run this farm. Mm. And it's not clear from reading it whether he grew up there. It sounds possibly like he didn't, but I might be wrong on that. So he's obviously got some self-awareness. He was a literature professor or an academic. He was a literature academic who suddenly just, at one point he says, God, I haven't read a book in ages. But I've forgotten that's what I used to do, you know, read books and study them. And now I'm just like the weather, you know, the weather becomes this thing that's no longer good or bad. There's no such thing as good weather or bad weather. There's just weather and you deal with weather in the way that you have to, you know, rain means doing this thing or snow means doing that thing or hot weather means that, you know, and it's all about, right, regardless of what you need, you know, what you feel like, you know, you have to feed the sheep, you have to make sure they're okay, you have to do these tasks, rain, sun, snow, Christmas Day, like whatever. It's just suddenly it's there's that element of choice is taken away. You can't just sort of lie about and have a day off and blah, blah, blah. And you just sort of, you know, getting into the rhythms of the natural world and all this sort of stuff. So it was kind of, yeah, it was lovely. It was quite, there was something, ended up being something oddly philosophical about it. I'm sure it was trying to impart some greater truths to me. Maybe we all need to look to sheep.
Well, I started to wonder how much like that getting in touch with nature, that sounds like a really wanky way of putting it, but you know what I mean? Mm. Like spending, not just spending more time outside, but acknowledging that you're sort of part in the universe, if you like. God, I can't say this in a way that doesn't sound like I'm a dickhead. But I think it sort of comes to most of us as we get older is what I'm starting to think about. And that whole weather thing. So my boyfriend works outside. And honestly, I've never met anybody who knows exactly what the weather's doing like he does. Mm. And he says people always say to him that like in summer, they're always jealous that he's outside. And then they're like, oh, it gets this time of year. And they're like, oh, you must hate it. And he loves it. Like, not that he doesn't get absolutely drenching wet and it's some days that aren't, you know, miserable because you soaked through and you've had to change clothes three times. But it'll like, you know, come home and he'll like, oh, it's really windy and this happened. And you know what I mean? He sees all the exciting bits of it and the way that the seasons change. And yeah, I think I've lost it. I might start a sheep farm.
Well, I can recommend a book to get you started. What about you? What have you been reading?
Well, it's spooky season, isn't it? I count season as like the whole of November spooky season as far as I'm concerned. So I've been reading about Small Angels by Lauren Owen, which is a gothic novel that came out, I think, in August, which is a bit of a weird time to bring a gothic novel out now, but I guess I'm reading it now, so you know, there we are. It's got all the gothic traits. So we are in a little town that I want to call Mockbeggar, but the woods are called Mockbeggar. So now I can't remember. I don't think that's the name of the town, but anyway, no, it's not even a town. It's a village. But anyway, so Mockbeggar's the wood, and on the edge of the wood, there is a little chapel called Small Angels, which is where Chloe wants to get married. Chloe didn't grow up here. Chloe is the bride-to-be of a guy called Sam, who did grow up in the village. His sister Kate as well. Kate has had to have some convincing to come back and come to the wedding. Everybody's being a bit secretive about what the fuck is going on. It starts off in the pub where this guy, Brian, who is like the local keeper of all the tales, tries to tell them the story. And other people try to stop him. And Chloe's like, no, I'm really interested. And you know who's going to cop for it from that point on, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
But there is more to it than that. So you get sort of two stories going on. So there's the preparations for the wedding. And sort of intermingled with that are Sam and his sister Kate, their parents were like emotionally abusive and like domestically abusive to each other. So you get a sort of bit of backstory with them, but now they seem a bit more, they don't talk, everything gets brushed under the carpet, but now they've got older and the kids have left, they seem a bit more sort of settled, but it's a bit disconcerting if you know anything about those sorts of marriages. And the other story that happens is the story of when Kate and Sam were kids. Now, Sam didn't get involved as much, but Kate was very much involved with Mottbagger and the family. So there's a house just near the woods, which was lived in by the Gone family, who had been there for years. And everybody thinks they've all gone, but one of them, Lucia, has come back. So one of the sisters died when Kate and Lucia were younger. The other two sisters have left to live elsewhere, and Lucia had, but she's come back. So the other part of the story is the unraveling of what's in the woods, why it's in the woods, how people end up getting trapped in the woods. Obviously, there's mist and there's dogs, and bits of it reminded me of Wuthering Heights and maybe a bit of Hounds of the Baskerville type stuff going on. But also at the heart of it, there is this queer love story that is quite beautiful and gets a really nice resolution. I'm just trying to do that without spoilers, but there is a really sort of beautiful other story happening. And I enjoyed that more than the modern day bride getting married thing. But it's partly because I don't like weddings, I don't care. But That twist in a way that I didn't expect it to, which was nice. I thought it was going to be fairly straightforward as to what was going to happen. And really what the book's about is so of course, like gothic stories are very much that everybody sits around and tells a tale and starts to get the shit out of each other stuff. But it's also about the stories that families tell about each other, you know, that way you get sort of stuck in it, your family sticks you in a role and that's who you are, and also how you internalize those stories and what that does to you and to your life then, if you sort of stick with, well, you know, uncle whatever once told me that I was like this, and that becomes a sort of personality trait that you believe is part of who you are, rather than going, yeah, fuck off. So there's some interesting stuff around that and roles and people having to think outside of the roles and whether people can change and that sort of thing. So I thought it was one of those books that I thought you'd probably enjoy even more than I did, because it's very sort of plot, and you like gothic, but it's very plot driven in a way that I wouldn't normally read, but I quite like reading at this time of year. So there we go.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I do have a copy, courtesy of you. Thank you, whoever sent you two copies. So yes, I'm really looking forward to it when I get a chance to get to it. It does sound absolutely up my street. I mean, you've got gothic, you've got plot, you've got queer love story. I mean, tick, tick, tick.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Splendid. Speaking of gothic, let's move on to the two books that we are talking about this week. The first of which is Mexican Gothic by Silvia Moreno Garcia, published by Quercus 2020. And then Slum Virgin by Gabriela Gabazon Camara, which is translated by Francis Riddle, Charco Press, originally written 2009, published here in English in 2017. Now, end of last week, I said, Frances Riddle, I'm sure we read a book that was translated by her. And it wasn't a book that we did on the podcast, but it is a book we've both read, which is Cockfight, which is one of those particularly visceral collections of short stories that we both independently read last year at some point.
Yeah, I think I talked about it as one of my what I'd have been reading that week.
You did. You did, yes, and I read it as well. Anyway, so that's the translator of that. But we're starting with Mexican Gothic, which, I love both of these books. I thought Mexican Gothic was great. It is basically the story of Naomi Tabawada, who lives in Mexico City. It's set in the 1950s. She's a kind of socialite, party girl about town, likes to go to parties, she smokes cigarettes, she goes on dates with young men, And she enjoys piano playing, which also speaks very good English. She's been doing English lessons her whole life and she speaks excellent English. This is important to know. One day her father, she's also kind of an eternal student. She keeps changing her mind about what she wants to study. And one day her wealthy father gets a letter from Noemi's cousin, Catalina, who has been very quiet of late. She's been a while ago married to Virgil Doyle and gone to live at his family home called High Place. And Noemi's father gets this letter that has him rather concerned for her physical and mental health. It's sort of raving, really. So convinces Noemi to go and see Catalina, see if she needs help. Virgil isn't allowing him to send a psychiatrist to see her. So Noemi is going to go and check on Catalina, and her father says, look, if you do this, I'll pay for your masters. And she goes, okay, then that's fine, let's do that then. Get there, and the family are very odd. The Doyle family, who originally were English and have moved to Mexico some generations ago to run a silver mine. The silver mine has collapsed. It's, all the miners got sick and died. The mine has ceased to be. And now it is Howard Doyle, the kind of patriarch of the family, then Virgil, who is married to Catalina, and Florence, and Florence's son, Francis, who all live in this rather spooky old mansion up the top of a hill somewhere. And then weird shit happens, basically. That's where we're starting, really. I loved this. We don't want to give spoilers, so we're going to have to be somewhat careful how we discuss this. But certainly the initial implication is that there are weird hauntings. People start, Noemi starts seeing things and having odd dreams, and there's this incredible scene where she's dreaming that the house is pulsating. Basically, she's becoming the house has become an organ, and she touches the walls and they're all fleshy and pulsating, and it's like, this is wonderful. I love it.
Well, I am going to point out, because they do appear before that scene you've just mentioned, the mushrooms we were looking for in episode one in Act of God, they're here. They were here all along. They're just in Mexican Gothic. So this was a 10 out of 10 no notes for me for two reasons. Weird fucking mushrooms and the main character's called Naomi. Done.
Done.
No notes.
Moving on to our next book.
No, yeah. I love this. So I read Velvet is the Night, which is by the same author, but came out after Mexican Gothic last year, and loved it. And I love this too. I just think she is a brilliant storyteller. So I always say this about Kerrin Millwood Hargreaves, that she tells a cracking yarn in a really good way. And this was a cracking good yarn told in a really brilliant way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely loved it too. I don't know where to start, because there's not too much weird shit that we can talk about, because if we talk about all the weird shit, then we're just going to give away all the good bits that are revealed and make it really exciting. But yeah, if you like weird shit, you have to read this. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there are definitely themes that we can get into. And one of the big themes, I think, is around eugenics, racial purity, the bloodline, kind of colonialism and all this sort of stuff. And in this way, although it's set in the 1950s, in lots of ways, it read to me very much like a kind of late Victorian kind of fantasy-ec type novel that had, and also with nods to the kind of truly traditional Gothic from the kind of 18th century. You've got the freaky house, you've got the insular community, the family don't like her breaking any rules. You know, she wants to kind of go into town and smoke cigarettes. Smoking cigarettes is a thing that comes up, and please don't smoke in the house, it bothers us, for reasons that become clear later on, which are not the reasons you're expecting, frankly. she keeps convincing Francis, and of course, I can only assume that Francis is named after Francis Galton, is the kind of godfather of eugenics. Galton is referenced quite early in the book. Howard Doyle, the patriarch, has this conversation with Noemi where he's sort of testing her views on eugenics and bloodline, and she finds all these journals, and you know, there's like stuff from the Galton Society. So I mean, the fact that this kind of son of the family is called Francis can't be a kind of coincidence. You know, but Francis is the kind of sympathetic ear, and he's trying to warn her basically that weird shit is happening. Like, this house is not the house. Get out, go. And she's like, no, I can't leave my cousin. I'm seeing this through. I'm nothing if I'm not stubborn. Something's going on with Catalina. I'm seeing this through. And, you know, that's the kind of chink in the armor where it comes to finding out really what's behind this obsession with bloodline. So on the one hand, it's sort of that straightforward colonialism. The family only trust things that are English, which is why it's important that Noemi does speak English. You know, one of the things she's asked, in the house, we only speak English. Mm. And you know, in the mine, we're told that they brought in English workers. They brought miners over from England to work in this mine, as well as some sort of local Mexican ones. And then when everyone died during these epidemics of weird illness, the Mexican ones were all kind of sent off to be buried by their families, or the ones that weren't were kind of stuck in mass graves on the site of the house, whereas the English ones were all given sort of very respectful funerals on the land, and there's a cemetery on the land, which is all the English workers. The doctor they have has been brought over from England. You know, they won't trust the local doctor who Noemi does go and see. She manages to convince Francis to take her into town. She goes to see the young local doctor, and you know, the Doyle family are outraged. So yes, this you know, the kind of the colonial plague, as it were, is a really obvious kind of obsession with purity and bloodline and eugenics and so on and so forth. But there's actually a lot more to it, and it turns out the freaky mushrooms are involved.
I mean, the whole summation of that, when you get to it, is completely batshit. But also, I bought the whole thing. I bought it all, like hook, line, and sinker. But yeah, I was sort of fascinated by that, and how much the whole thing could be read as an allegory for colonialism, and how much white people fucked up Central America, basically, and anywhere else. I mean, you could transpose it to loads of different places. One of the things that really got me, because I did a bit about Lombroso and phrenology and degeneration when I was at university, and obviously I write about sideshows, so I'm fascinated about all that sort of stuff. And so that, and the way that sort of linked with class as well, and it made me think about how actually this thing we do where the media put up a photo of somebody who's committed a crime or whatever, has been charged with something, and we all go, oh yeah, they look like a criminal, and how that's like, it's come from Lombroso, and how that sort of, yeah, filtered through to how we still sort of think that about, it's a way of controlling people, and particularly like lower class people. I have got to read this bit though, because the bit before, when they're talking about Galton, it just proper made me laugh, this bit. So it made me laugh, but also like furious. But anyway, did you ever hear about Dr. Galton's beauty map? He went around the British Isles compiling a record of the women he saw. He catalogued them as attractive, indifferent, or repellent. London ranked as the highest for beauty, Aberdeen the lowest. It might seem like a funny exercise, but of course it had its logic. Well, of course it does, because then London becomes the centre of the universe where everything's great, which in that sense, it's frustrating and annoying, because it still is the case, but also it's sort of funny that like it gets further north and you're just like, yeah, all right, fuck off. We didn't want you anyway. Don't come round here with your eugenics. We're not having any of it. We've already got six fingers. It's all right. That was a joke. Yeah, he is wondering.
So, I mean, all of that is why it sort of felt quite Victorian to me, Mm-hmm. I almost had to keep reminding myself that it was set in the 1950s. And it's sort of irrelevant, actually, when it's set, because one of the things about this house and where they are, and they're kind of so completely cut off, is it's sort of timeless. And in ways that I won't go into for spoilers, it's sort of outside of time. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, yes, you've got this sort of modern 1950s socialite, but suddenly she's thrown back into this almost Victorian, just very odd, very traditional in a kind of family line sense, very untraditional in other ways. But yet there's also, you know, I also thought a lot about Haunting of Hill House, Shirley Jackson, which of course she was influenced by the Gothic and the Victorian and so on as well. So it all links up. So I think it's there are a lot of very commercial sort of horror stories in the world. And this is probably one of the best I've read in a really long time. It's really easy to do horror badly.
Mm.
And she does it really, really well. Mm. And I have to say, and this is probably somewhat snobbishness on my part, the fact that this has been a massively commercially successful novel, huge hit, there was part of me kind of going, it'll be fine. But it was so much better than I was expecting.
See, I think because I'd read Velvet is a Night, which I only bought, I will confess this, I bought it for the cover because it's cool as fuck. It looks like Jennifer Lopez in like Hustlers, basically, but just a sort of face pic. So it's a woman smoking with big shades on, because it's set in the 70s, again, in Mexico, but it's all there. It's about the killings and the disappearances, and there are things that you could parallel. I mean, it's not weird shit in the way that this is weird shit, but in terms of plotting, there's some similarities as to like how things play out. And there's a I'm going to use the word feisty, and I hate that word, but there is a sort of feisty female character, which I thought sort of fit. I think it fits. I hate it normally when people describe female characters like that, but they seem to be such a foil to the male characters.
Mm.
At least the two books that I've read. So I sort of knew. I knew what I was getting. I mean, I read Velvet is the Night and went and bought like three more of her books because she's great. And I think it's very difficult, like you said, it's very difficult to write something that is readable in that way that people go, you know, when people mean it was easy to, or like easy-ish to read. Like it flows, it's gripping, it's entertaining, but also it's got a really serious point to make, and it's well written, and it's so difficult to do that. Because you can easily overwhelm it with the politics, or you can get lost and the plot don't work, and the thing that she does is so batshit that I don't know how she worked it out.
Yeah, because I'm the same as you. I completely bought it. You know, when there is this big reveal of what's truly going on at High Place, you know, if I were to describe it now, which I won't because spoilers, but if I were to describe it now, you'd be like, what? But actually, when you're reading it, you're like, yes, of course. That's totally what happens. That makes total sense to me. And that is such a skill. It's so hard to do well when you're writing something outrageous. When I say outrageous, I mean in the kind of the literal sense. It's so easy to overdo it and to lose your reader at that point. You know, you don't. So many times I've read novels and the reveal has happened and you're just like, oh God. really and that there's none of that with this. It's incredibly well done, and I do want to go. I did want to read this book anyway, I, you know, obviously, but I was so impressed with this that I definitely want to read much more, and I definitely want to read Velvet as a Night.
I think the other thing with this, and I think I can do this without spoiling it because it's not what happens, but because mushrooms are involved and I'm a little bit obsessed with fungi at the minute, so I went on a foraging walk with someone that me and my boyfriend knew on Sunday looking for fungi. I can't believe how much fungi there is, you know, when you go looking in the wood, like if you know where to look, It's fucking everywhere, right? Which I sort of knew from, you know, the Entangled Life, Melvin Sheldrake, which I've got but haven't read yet. So I am planning to read it. But the one thing that sort of filtered through from all of that is how much fungi there is living under the earth and how it's all interconnected. And quite a long time ago now, because I know it was the early days of my blog, I read Alia Whiteley's first book. So she writes science fiction, and I can't remember what it's called, but that is about mushrooms in a different way to this one. But I have never forgotten it. And I am absolutely obsessed that they're going to take over the world, because, you know, they're the most, it's the highest number, they've got the highest number of species. They can communicate. Do you know they can communicate through the earth to each other? Yeah, so they communicate. They've got these webs. And I learned this on the walk on Sunday. This, and I didn't know this. This was amazing. So prior to us having trees, there were giant mushrooms, basically. They were the biggest species, and they broke down, and it was them breaking down that created the environment for trees to grow in.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I love
Why are we not told this?
I love all this shit. They are going to take over the world. So the other thing...
They are weird, though. That's the thing. I mean, I find mushrooms quite weird. Like... because you get, it's so easy to die, for never mind anything else. There will, there's mushrooms will kill you as soon as look at you. Yeah. And then there are other ones that are delicious with your dinner. Like, it's just such a roulette.
It's, well, it's part of the things when you go looking for them as well, that there are species that are really similar, and there'll be like one way you can tell which one's the deadly one and which one's not. And apparently even some of the ones that we eat, some of those are still poisonous to people who can't, if they've not been cooked properly, or you can't ingest them properly, or they are a bit of a roulette wheel. But yeah, I'm absolutely fascinated with mushrooms, and I am, like, I want to write something about them one day, because I am convinced they're just gonna like take over. They the other thing that I learned on Sunday as well, about how much they're being used to break things down. So they could, so where we went for a walk used to be an industrial site, because everywhere in Sheffield used to be an industrial site, and how they're breaking down that, like, the chemicals that would have been in the earth, but also like labs are using them now to break down plastics. Like, it's very slow because they can only do a tiny bit at a time. But yeah, they break down all sorts of they break down all sorts of stuff. So like they're basically like nature's, I don't know, cleaner uppers.
That's so interesting. I had no idea.
Yeah.
So they, I need to read Entangled Life as well now.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons that I love this book so much, because like that's, and I thought that was going to be the, so there's a point where Francis is, it's all misty, it's misty in the graveyard, and Francis peers out of the mist and he's been picking mushrooms, and I was like, oh, here we go. But they were mushrooms you could eat, and I was like, ooh, where's she going with
it? Though he did point out a poisonous one, because she steps on one, do you remember? And he's, because he's telling her which ones are, like, you can tell by the spores which ones has white spores and which ones are poisonous. And he has all these drawings. She goes into his room at one point, and she has all these kind of botanical drawings. And that's what he spends his time doing when he's not involved in his very odd family, is drawing these botanical paintings of mushrooms and stuff. I loved Francis.
He's a great character.
He's really good. Yeah, love this. These are the freaky mushrooms we wanted.
Absolutely.
No freaky mushrooms in Slum Virgin, though. I don't think.
There was an insult about a pigeon, though. Did you notice that?
And there was a brilliant comparison to an octopus, which I'll come to. I wrote it down and everything. Slum Virgin by Gabriella Gabazon Camara, translated by Francis Riddle. This is a very short novel set in Buenos Aires in Argentina. Two narrators. So it's, the main one is Quitty, who is a journalist. Her name's Catalina as well, actually, her real name. Mm. But Catalina's all over the place. Quitty is a journalist who has come to this slum in Buenos Aires to write about a trans woman called Cleo, who was a sex worker and sort of refashions herself as the slum virgin after a miracle happens in a police station, which is quite the miracle, which we'll get to. And she's built up this the slum as this kind of community around this model of the Virgin, known as the Virgin, that's sort of made out of concrete, the Virgin Mother. And when the novel opens, we're told that Quitty is now married to Cleo. They're now living in Miami. They have a daughter. Actually, right at the beginning, she's pregnant with the daughter. And we know that the slum has been destroyed. We know that many, many people have been killed, including Quitty's son, adoptive son, Kevin. And the book is essentially Quitty writing what happened, but Cleo interjecting and going, no, you've got this bit wrong and you've forgotten this bit. And here's the background to this of what you're talking about. Essentially, it's the story of a community that is built around Cleo, or becomes built around Cleo, and how the wider city outside resents that, destroys it, and how Quitty and Cleo's life goes on from there. It packs a lot into a really short book, right?
It does, yeah. I just want to put a trigger warning in there, because I know you've already mentioned, so Kevin's death
is horrific.
Yes. There is also rape, child rape. lots of. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. There's some quite grim.
There's some pretty horrible violence in there as well. And I have to say, this is probably the first time of any book that we've done on the podcast where I have actually had to skim read part of it. I know we talked when we were talking about Hurricane by Fernanda Melchor, there were some bits that were just like, oh, this is quite grim. Kevin's death, Kevin is five, the description of Kevin's death I genuinely found too much and had to kind of skim. So there's probably 10 or 15 pages that I'm afraid I didn't properly read. I just sort of skimmed because it was horrific, actually, just awful. And so, yes, massive trigger warning for that. But I will say, that aside, the book is great. I mean, the writing is so immediate, like you're just in from page one kind of thing.
Yeah, I thought the voice was brilliant, and that was the thing that got me into it. I will say that some of the language, so it was written in 2007 originally, so some of the language used will make people wince, which I don't think it's deliberate, because I deliberately went to look up the author, and she is part of a group who created an intersectional feminist movement amongst authors in Argentina. We're in Argentina, aren't we? Sorry, my brain's gone like Mexico, Argentina, where are we? but some of the language used is quite 1970s is the way I'd put it. So just a warning if you're going in there and you're not expecting it. Again, like Hurricane, it reminded me of Hurricane Season a lot, actually, in terms of the people that were involved, the immediacy, the voice, the language that was used, the violence. I think it had quite a lot of parallels with that in certain ways. But I did also really enjoy it. However, I'm just going to start with Quitty because I fucking hated her. I absolutely loathed her. It reminded me a bit. Do you remember when we read Leslie Jameson's essays and we read that one about the photojournalist who went and photographed that family over years and years and years? So Quitty rocks up because she wants to make her story to get a grant so she can do more work. And she basically becomes a poverty tourist. She ends up stopping because she ends up so fucking drunk that she can't like do anything else. But when it comes to the point where they raid, whether the slums raided, she is out of there going to the office to work out whether she's taking another sabbatical or whether they're going to sack her. And as soon as she hears about it, although she tells her how devastated she is about what's happened, she goes back to her pristine flat. And that's where Cleo eventually finds her. And I'm just like, fuck off. And also the reason that Cleo interjects is because Quitty's trying to tell someone else's story. And the whole thing with Kevin, she wasn't even there, but she tries to tell that story. And Cleo's like, that's not how it happens. This is how it happened. And she only lets Cleo have certain points where she tells it in her voice, which I find, I mean, it's really well written. This is not like frustration at the author, it's frustration at fucking Quentin and white people and journalists and, you know, that. Partly, I suppose, because this is one of the things that I'm writing about is where when other people tell a certain community's story, because then it brings them money or fame or whatever. So she's really frustrated. And there were two particular bits that I picked out that really pissed me off, because this is very like, oh, you working class person, you don't know what, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. So there's a bit partway through where one of the things they do is when Cleo starts talking to the Virgin Mary, she tells her to build a pond. So she builds a pond. Well, they know there's water under the land, so it's fairly straightforward, actually, to build a pond. And then all these architects turn up because stuff's sort of floated to the top and they want to look at it. Mm. And so amongst all these committees that they've got, they add the historical committee, who are in charge of working with the archaeologists, who were happy to be able to teach their science to the community, and the community was happy to learn something other than a technical skill so poorly taught that it wouldn't even have landed Theseus a job. All those courses in sewing or computing, knitting, healthy eating, and whatever other bullshit the ruling classes seem to think people in the slum need in order to better themselves. And I mean, that's not quitty, but that sort of general thing about, oh yeah, what you need to do is that thing that's slightly above where you are in life, not like you might be interested in this thing, off you go and do it. And the other thing is right near the beginning, you can tell how annoyed I am, because I'm just like, can I talk a bit faster? Maybe I can try. But right at the beginning, when Quit is introducing what's happening, she's talking about Cleo mentions, where are we? The Virgin says that being alive is the best, and Achilles knew as much when he was in Hades. When that guy who took 10 years to get home, what was his name? Ulysses. When he said to him, oh, hello, King of the Dead, Achilles answered, give me a break, Ulysses. I'd rather be a slave or an indigent is like a poor person, Quitty, and be alive than reign over the kingdom of the dead. My daughter enjoyed the speeches of the queerer of her two mothers, seeming to dance as we listened to her. As for me, they threw me into confusion. How could she cite the Odyssey almost word for word? She'd never read it in her fucking life. Where the hell did she get things like that from? Maybe the Virgin actually did exist and was into the classics as well as poor prostitutes. And I am like, for all your being a journalist, Quitty, you thick fucker, it's an oral text. It was passed on orally. Duh. So, rant over.
No, I'm absolutely with you. And it sort of continues. I mean, what happens when they get to Miami is that they have, or particularly Quitty has written this kind of cumbia, the kind of opera type thing, based around the story of the slum. And we find out that it has made them millions, millions and millions and millions. They are absolutely rolling in money by this point. And of course, what she's ended up doing, although she kind of excuses it by going in, well, Cleo's her wife, they have a child together, you know, they're living together. It's using, you know, Cleo's story. Essentially, what she's done is created this thing that has no doubt been seen by largely rarefied audiences, by people that have got the money to spend on tickets and so on and so forth. And so has, although it's telling the story of what happened and the massacre, it's sort of exploited them over again and made them a vast amount of money. And ultimately, at the end, and this is somewhat a spoiler, but I don't think it's not the kind of spoiler. It's not like Mexican Gothic, where this is a massive plot point. Cleo goes and wants to start another community, you know, another slum, essentially. She wants to refine that community that meant the world to her. And Quitty is furious that she's taken a huge amount of the money, not all of it, but a huge amount of the money, and has gone off to do this again, when in fact actually Cleo is the sort of realer one. She's the one that wants to rebuild this thing that she's lost. Whereas Critty's just like, come back with my money, bitch. Also, you've left me with the kid that you love and I'm sort of ambivalent about, really. Mm. You know, it just perpetuates. It's the same thing. She's sitting in her lovely, pristine Miami apartment overlooking the whatever. Whereas Cleo's gone, you know, I want to go back and have some meaning in my life, essentially. Mm.
Because I think the other thing that it was really about for me was it's anti-capitalist and very much about community and how you build a community, and that you can be in the biggest shithole in the world, essentially, and still create something that means something to people that are there. And it reminded me, so Cleo, when she starts talking through the Virgin, it reminded me of Emily Mitikori-Kawa's book that we read in episode 2, and the way that those spiritualists use their gift, I say that in quote marks, to push for social change. And that's what Cleo does. What she does is then, like, she uses it as a way to give messages to the community to try and, you know, control the violence, to stop them all getting pregnant and passing on diseases. She creates something that, you know, it talks about how, Quitty talks about how, like, Cleo and the daughter are always, like, bouncing and happy, and there's that vibe all the time. And they know, the bit that I thought was really interesting was when they say that party starts at whatever time, and if someone hadn't turned up for 2 days, they know that they're either dead or they've been arrested, and they go looking for them. And it's that, like, they know, they all come together, they know where people are, they're in people's lives, they're concerned about what they're doing. And she starts to educate them, like, what she's doing is really important. And that's what pisses off the Beast, who's the guy, the like, you know, criminal who's running everything, and the police, who aren't making money out of it anymore. And that's why they go in and raid the slum, because they're fucked off that these people have got some power for themselves.
And have achieved all those things that these kind of government programs and these kind of well-meaning sorts set out to do, and that they've the violence has gone down. They're feeding themselves. You know, the Virgin told us we've got to start aquaculture, and they do it by digging into the kind of water-laden ground and stealing some koi carp from a Japanese garden that then proliferate rapidly. But they can feed themselves, you know, well, and so they're well fed, they are cleaning up their, you know, they make a point of trying to make things clean and tidy. They, you know, violence is dropping, pregnancy is dropping, all of those things that all of these programs set out to do, but they do it on their own terms and in their own way. And yes, it might be via the medium of a trans slum virgin, but that's what works for that, you know, that has worked. And that's what Cleo is trying to recapture, I think, when she goes off. And I think also related to that idea of community was the kind of function of religion. Mm. And this is something I've thought a lot about as someone who grew up in a religious household who no longer has any sort of faith, was, you know, the function of religion in society. And I think it's, you know, there are a lot of people who will very simplistically say, you know, all organized religion is bad, wars have happened, it's a massive, and that's absolutely true. But also what churches and places of worship and religious communities can do on a very local level is give people community and meaning where they can't find it anywhere else. And that's what happens here. There's a bit where it says, but later I understood no God was listening to them, but they were listening to themselves and they were listening together, and it was the joining of forces that mattered. And it sort of then becomes irrelevant if there really is a God there or not, or whether you really believe there is a God or not. The point is, the goodness that is said meant to come out of religion is happening. And the fact of whether it's real or not doesn't matter, because the result is real. And that is what gives Cleo the meaning in her life. You know, she's come from this horrific background of abuse. She has gone through God knows what. But now she's found a community that she loves and that loves her. And that's what makes it, I think there's a really interesting tension then between the kind of journalist and the kind of, because of course the TV can't get enough of her and the slime, you know, this incredible story. And on one hand, that's ultimately what kills them, is the, all the attention on what an amazing job they've done. But also, Cleo loves the fame. She absolutely laps it up. She bases her kind of aesthetic on this TV star called Susanna, who she treats, you know, she regards as like the queen. So on one hand, she's sort of been anointed in this way that she's always been desperate for. She is this beloved TV famous person, but it becomes her downfall. The downfall of the community, and literally the death of hundreds of people. There's a really interesting tension there. And then in the way that obviously Quitty takes a very kind of exploitative, even if Quitty doesn't quite grasp that's what she's doing herself, I think there's some awareness at one point where she goes, you know, I initially saw Cleo as this project, as if she no longer did. But ultimately, of course, she does. I mean, she's gone on to make her fortune through this, you know, Cumbia.
Well, and also she comes to Cleo gradually. So at one point, she's shagging one of Cleo's relatives before she ends up with Cleo. And it's very much that, like, she's been drawn into that sort of electric nature. That, I mean, Cleo's larger than life, and I don't fucking follow that. You know what I mean? You just, like, you can see how you get drawn to that. But I think that, yeah, Quitty doesn't realise that that's what she's done. She's a bit, and then it's trapped her, because she's trapped herself, because, yeah, I don't think she does understand what she's done. That doesn't make it any less frustrating.
No, completely.
Because that's
made it more.
Well, again, that's back to white people not realising their own complicity, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was thinking about what you were talking then as well, was that I'd said about it being capitalist, and the place, one of the places that Cleo really wants to go to at the end is Cuba. Which is really interesting, because Cuba's still a communist state, but, you know, there's that whole argument about whether that's worse or better or exactly the same as being, like, you know, as far down the capitalist path as we are here now.
Yeah, sort of two sides of totalitarianism, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
I must come back to the octopus quote, though, which has absolutely no relevance to anything else, but just made me laugh. Here's the quote. It's about a security guard who's on this kind of booth just on, like, by the entrance to the slum. The security guard looked like just another decoration, a surprised octopus poking his head out of the booth's window. I love that. Just a surprised octopus. It's so immediately visually arresting.
Can he predict football scores with his tentacles?
Well, there is a World Cup coming up.
Oh, yeah, let's not talk about that.
No, we're all boycotting it. I don't care about football anyway, but...
No, I do care about the fact it's in Qatar, though.
Indeed.
Mm.
No octopuses for them.
Is Paul the octopus still alive?
Does anybody know? I don't know what the lifespan of an octopus is.
Probably not very long.
But I don't think it's that long.
Oh, well. R.I.P. Paul.
We barely knew you.
This took an unexpected turn.
Mushrooms, octopus.
Weird shit.
And the pigeons.
Well segued, Duel.
Thanks. Thanks very much.
Next week.
Oh, we've got a meaty one. Next week we are reading.
I'm not sure how appropriate that is, but all right.
No, as I said it, I thought that's come out wrong. anyway, appropriate adjectives, ahoy. We're reading Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, Intimate Histories of Writers, Black Girls, Troublesome Women and Queer Radicals by Saidia Hartman, and My Body Keeps Your Secrets by Lucia. Is it Lucia or Lucia? I'm going to find that out for next week. Osborne Crowley. So, two books with a lot to get our teeth into, and possibly, I'm just going to call it now, not that many mushrooms.
Do you think?
I mean, I may be proved wrong.
You never know. In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. I would mention Twitter, but I've left because Elon Musk, which has just rendered every episode we've ever done like.
But I'm still there. Kirsty's you can follow me on Kirsty's... the other Kirsty.
Yes, she's at the other Kirsty, and you'll be able to find out what book she's publishing next year. That's exciting. Well, not just the publishing, but you're
just me.
Promoting.
Just the ones. That's me. One man band. Excellent. Me.
So we will see you next week for lots of feminist talk. Like, it's not feminist chat on here every week.
Never.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.